Chapter 13. Within 5 minutes after the countryman found the fire, the people began to gather. Some of them, also on the way to town in wagons to spend Saturday, also stopped. Some came afoot from the immediate neighborhood. This was a region of Negro cabins and gutted and outworn fields out of which a corporal's guard of detectives couldn't have combed 10 people, man, woman, or child, yet which now, within 30 minutes, produced, as though out of thin air, parties and groups ranging from single individuals to entire families. Still others came out from town in racing and blatting cars. Among these came the sheriff of the county, a fat, comfortable man with a hard, canny head and a benevolent aspect, who thrust away those who crowded to look down at the body on the sheet with that static and childlike amaze with which adults contemplate their own inescapable portraits. Among them, the casual Yankees and the poor whites, and even the Southerners who had lived for a while in the North, who believed aloud that it was an anonymous Negro crime, committed not by a Negro, but by Negro, and who knew, believed, and hoped that she'd been ravished, too, at least once before her throat was cut, and at least once afterward. The sheriff came up and looked himself once, and then sent the body away, hiding the poor thing from the eyes. Then there was nothing for them to look at except the place where the body had lain, and the fire. And soon nobody could remember exactly where the sheet had rested, what earth it had covered, and so then there was only the fire to look at. So they looked at the fire with that same dull and static amaze which they'd brought down from the old fetid caves where knowing began, as though, like death, they'd never seen fire before. Presently the fire truck came up, gallantly, with noise, with whistles and bells. It was new, painted red, with gilt trim, and a hand-power siren, and a bell gold in color and in tone serene, arrogant, and proud. About it, hatless men and youths clung with the astonishing disregard of physical laws that flies possess. It had mechanical ladders that sprang to prodigious heights at the touch of a hand, like opera hats, only there was now nothing for them to spring to. It had neat and virgin coils of hose, evocative of telephone trust advertisements in the popular magazines, but there was nothing to hook them to, and nothing to flow through them. So the hatless men, who had deserted counters and desks, swung down, even including the one who ground the siren. They came too, and were shown several different places where the sheet had lain, and some of them, with pistols already in their pockets, began to canvass about for someone to crucify. But there wasn't anybody. She'd lived such a quiet life, attended so to her own affairs, that she bequeathed to the town in which she'd been born and lived and died, a foreigner, an outlander, a kind of heritage of astonishment and outrage, for which, even though she'd supplied them at last with an emotional barbecue, a Roman holiday almost, they would never forgive her and let her be dead in peace and quiet. Not that. Peace is not that often. So they moiled and clotted, believing that the flames, the blood, the body that had died 3 years ago and had just now begun to live again, cried out for vengeance, not believing that the rapt infury of the flames and the immobility of the body were both affirmations of an attained bourne beyond the hurt and harm of man. Not that. Because the other made nice believing. Better than the shelves and the counters filled with long familiar objects bought, not because the owner desired them or admired them, could take any pleasure in the owning of them, but in order to cajole or trick other men into buying them at a profit, and who must now and then contemplate both the objects, which hadn't yet sold, and the men who could buy them, but hadn't yet done so, with anger and maybe outrage and maybe despair, too. better than the musty offices where the lawyers waited lurking among ghosts of old lusts and lies, or where the doctors waited with sharp knives and sharp drugs, telling man, believing that he should believe, without resorting to printed admonishments, that they labored for that end whose ultimate attainment would leave them with nothing whatever to do. And the women came too, the idle ones in bright and sometimes hurried garments, with secret and passionate and glittering looks, and with secret frustrated breasts, who've ever loved death better than peace, to print with a myriad small hard heels to the constant murmur, "Who did it? Who did it?" Periods such as perhaps, "Is he still free? Huh, is he? Is he?" The sheriff also stared at the flames with exasperation and astonishment, since there was no scene to investigate. He wasn't yet thinking of himself as having been frustrated by a human agent. It was the fire. It seemed to him that the fire had been self-born for that end and purpose. It seemed to him that that by and because of which he had had ancestors long enough to come himself to be had allied itself with crime. So he continued to walk in a baffled and fretted manner about that heedless monument of the color of both hope and catastrophe, until a deputy came up and told how he'd discovered in a cabin beyond the house traces of recent occupation. And immediately the countryman who had discovered the fire, he'd not yet got to town, his wagon hadn't progressed one inch since he descended from it 2 hours ago, and he now moved among the people, wild-haired, gesticulant, with on his face a dulled, spent, glaring expression, and his voice hoarsed almost to a whisper, remembered that he'd seen a man in the house when he broke in the door. "A white man," the sheriff said.
"Yes, sir. Blumping around in the hall, like he had just finished falling down the stairs. Tried to keep me from going upstairs at all. Told me I'd already been up there, and it wasn't nobody up there. And when I come back down, he was gone."
The sheriff looked about at them. "Who lived in that cabin?"
"I didn't know anybody did," the deputy said. "Niggers, I reckon. She might have had niggers living in the house with her, from what I've heard.
What I'm surprised at is that it was this long before one of them done for her."
"Get me a nigger," the sheriff said.
The deputy and two or three others got him a nigger.
"Who's been living in that cabin?"
the sheriff said.
"I don't know, Miss Watt," the negro said. "I never paid it no mind. I ain't even knowed anybody lived in it."
"Bring him on down here," the sheriff said.
This ends Disc 9.
They were gathering now about the sheriff and the deputy and the negro, with avid eyes upon which the sheer prolongation of empty flames had begun to pall, with faces identical one with another. It was as if all their individual five senses had become one organ of looking, like an apotheosis. The words that flew among them, wind or air engendered.
"Is that him? Is that the one who did it?
Sheriff's got him. Sheriff's already called him."
The sheriff looked at them.
"Go away," he said, "all of you. Go look at the fire. If I need any help, I can send for you. Go on away."
He turned and led his party down to the cabin. Behind him, the repulsed ones stood in a clump and watched the three white men and the negro enter the cabin and close the door. Behind them, in turn, the dying fire roared, filling the air, though not louder than the voices, and much more unsourceless.
"By God, if that's him, what are we doing standing around here? Murdering a white woman, the black son?"
None of them had ever entered the house. While she was alive, they wouldn't have allowed their wives to call on her. When they were younger, children, some of their fathers had done it too, they'd called after her on the streets, "Nigger lover, nigger lover." In the cabin, the sheriff sat down on one of the cots heavily. He sighed, a tub of a man with the complete and rock-like inertia of a tub. "Now, I want to know who lives in this cabin," he said.
"I done told you I don't know," Negro said. His voice was a little sullen, quite alert, covertly alert.
He watched the sheriff. The other two white men were behind him, where he couldn't see them. He didn't look back at them, not so much as a glance. He was watching the sheriff's face as a man watches a mirror. Perhaps he saw it as in a mirror before it came. Perhaps he didn't. Since if change, flicker there was in the sheriff's face, it was no more than a flicker. But the Negro didn't look back. There came only into his face, when the strap fell across his back, a wince, sudden, sharp, fleet, jerking up the corners of his mouth and exposing his momentary teeth like smiling. Then his face smoothed again, inscrutable.
"I reckon you ain't tried hard enough to remember," the sheriff said.
"I can't remember because I can't know," the Negro said. "I don't even live nowhere near here. You ought to know where I stay at, white folks."
"Mr. Buford says you live right down the road yonder," the sheriff said. "Lots of folks live down that road. Mr. Buford ought to know where I stay at."
"He's lying," the deputy said. His name was Buford. He was the one who wielded the strap, buckle end outward. He held it poised. He was watching the sheriff's face. He looked like a spaniel waiting to be told to spring into the water.
"Maybe so, maybe not," sheriff said. He mused upon the Negro. He was still, huge, inert, sagging the cot springs.
"I think he just don't realize yet that I ain't playing. Let alone them folks out there that ain't got no jail to put him into if anything he wouldn't like should come up. That wouldn't bother to put him into a jail if they had one."
Perhaps there was a sign, a signal in his eyes again, perhaps not. Perhaps the Negro saw it, perhaps not. The strap fell again, the buckle raking across the Negro's back.
"You remember yet?" the sheriff said. "It's two white men," the Negro said. His voice was cold, not sullen, not anything. "I don't know who they is, nor what they does. Ain't none of my business. I ain't never seen them. Just heard talk about how two white men lived here. I didn't care who they was. And that's all I know. You can whoop the blood out of me, but that's all I know."
Again, the sheriff sighed.
"That'll do. I reckon that's right.
It's that fella Christmas. He used to work at the mill. And another fella named Brown," the third man said. "You could have picked out any man in Jefferson that his breath smelled right, and he could have told you that much."
"I reckon that's right, too," the sheriff said.
He returned to town.
When the crowd realized that the sheriff was departing, a general exodus began. It was as if there were nothing left to look at now. The body had gone, and now the sheriff was going. It was as though he carried within him, somewhere within that inert and sighing mass of flesh, the secret itself. That which moved and evoked them as with a promise of something beyond the sluttishness of stuffed entrails and monotonous days. So there was nothing left to look at now but the fire. They'd now been watching it for 3 hours. They were now used to it, accustomed to it. Now it had become a permanent part of their lives as well as of their experiences. Standing beneath its windless column of smoke, taller than and impregnable as a monument, which could be returned to at any time.
So when the caravan reached town, it had something of that arrogant decorum of a procession behind a catafalque, the sheriff's car in the lead, the other cars honking and blatting behind, and the sheriff's in their own compounded dust. It was held up momentarily at a street intersection near the square by a country wagon which had stopped to let a passenger descend. Looking out, the sheriff saw a young woman climbing slowly and carefully down from the wagon with that careful awkwardness of advanced pregnancy. Then the wagon pulled aside, the caravan went on, crossing the square, where already the cashier of the bank had taken from the vaults the envelope which the dead woman had deposited with him, and which bore the inscription, "To be opened at my death, Joanna Burden." The cashier was waiting at the sheriff's office when the sheriff came in with the envelope and its contents. This was a single sheet of paper on which was written, by the same hand which inscribed the envelope, "Notify E.E. Peebles, attorney, Memphis, Tennessee, and Nathaniel Burrington, Exeter, New Hampshire." And that was all. "This Peebles is a nigger lawyer," the cashier said.
"That's so," sheriff said.
"Yeah. What do you want me to do?"
"I reckon you better do what the paper says," the sheriff said. "I reckon maybe I better do it myself."
He sent two wires. He received the Memphis reply in 30 minutes. The other came 2 hours later. Within 10 minutes afterward, the word had gone through the town that Miss Burden's nephew in New Hampshire offered $1,000 reward for the capture of her murderer. At 9 o'clock that evening, the man whom the countryman had found in the burning house when he broke in the front door appeared. They didn't know then that he was the man. He didn't tell them so. All they knew was that a man who had resided for a short time in the town, and whom they knew as a bootlegger named Brown, and not much of a bootlegger at that, appeared on the square in a state of excitement, seeking the sheriff. Then it began to piece together. The sheriff knew that Brown was associated somehow with another man, another stranger named Christmas, about whom, despite the fact that he'd lived in Jefferson for 3 years, even less was known than about Brown. It was only now that the sheriff learned that Christmas had been living in the cabin behind Miss Burden's house for 3 years. Brown wanted to talk. He insisted on talking, loud, urgent. It appeared at once that what he was doing was claiming the $1,000 reward.
"You want to turn state's evidence?" the sheriff asked him. "I don't want to turn nothing," Brown said, harsh, hoarse, a little wild in the face. "I know who done it, and when I get my reward, I'll tell."
"You catch the fellow that done it, and you'll get the reward," sheriff said.
So they took Brown to the jail for safekeeping. "Only I reckon it ain't no actual need of that," the sheriff said. "I reckon as long as that $1,000 is where he can smell it, you couldn't run him away from here." When Brown was taken away, still hoarse, still gesticulant and outraged, the sheriff telephoned to a neighboring town where there was a pair of bloodhounds. The dogs would arrive on the early morning train. About the bleak platform in the sad dawn of that Sunday morning, 30 or 40 men were waiting when the train came in, the lighted windows fleeing and jarring to a momentary stop. It was a fast train, and it didn't always stop at Jefferson. It halted only long enough to disgorge the two dogs. 1,000 costly tons of intricate and curious metal, glaring and crashing up and into an almost shocking silence, filled with the puny sounds of men, to vomit 2 gaunt and cringing phantoms, whose droop-eared and mild faces gazed with sad abjectness about at the weary, pale faces of men who hadn't slept very much since night before last, ringing them about with something terrible and eager and impotent. It was as if the very initial outrage of the murder carried in its wake and made of all subsequent actions something monstrous and paradoxical and wrong in themselves against both reason and nature. It was just sunrise when the posse reached the cabin behind the charred and now cold embers of the house. The dogs, either gaining courage from the light and warmth of the sun, or catching the strained, intense excitement from the men, began to surge and yap about the cabin. Snuffing loudly, and as one beast, they took a course, dragging the man who held the leashes. They ran side by side for 100 yards, where they stopped and began to dig furiously into the earth and exposed a pit where someone had buried recently emptied food tins. They dragged the dogs away by main strength. They dragged them some distance from the cabin and made another cast. For a short time the dogs moiled, whimpering. Then they set off again, full-tongued, drooling, and dragged and carried the running and cursing men at top speed back to the cabin, where, feet planted, and with back-flung heads and back-rolled eyeballs, they bayed the empty doorway with the passionate abandon of 2 baritones singing Italian opera. The men took the dogs back to town, in cars, and fed them. When they crossed the square, the church bells were ringing, slow and peaceful, and along the streets the decorous people moved sedately beneath parasols, carrying Bibles and prayer books. That night, a youth, a country boy, and his father came in to see the sheriff. The boy told of having been on the way home in a car late Friday night, and of a man who stopped him a mile or two beyond the scene of the murder with a pistol. The boy believed that he was about to be robbed and even killed, and he told how he was about to trick the man into permitting him to drive right up into his own front yard, where he intended to stop the car and spring out and shout for help, but that the man suspected something and forced him to stop the car and let him out. And the father wanted to know how much of the $1,000 would become theirs. "You catch him and we'll see," the sheriff said. So they waked the dogs and put them into another car, and the youth showed them where the man had got out, and they cast the dogs, who charged immediately into the woods, and with their apparent infallibility for metal in any form, found the old pistol, with its 2 loaded chambers, almost at once. "It's one of them old Civil War cap-and-ball pistols," the deputy said. "One of the caps has been snapped, but it never went off. What do you reckon he was doing with that?" "Turn them dogs loose," the sheriff said. "Maybe them leashes worry them." They did so. The dogs were free now. 30 minutes later, they were lost. Not the men lost the dogs lost the men. They were just across a small creek and a ridge, and the men could hear them plainly. They weren't baying now, with pride and assurance and perhaps pleasure. The sound which they now made was a long-drawn and hopeless wailing, while steadily the men shouted at them. But apparently the animals couldn't hear either. Both voices were distinguishable, yet the bell-like and abject wailing seemed to come from a single throat, as though the 2 beasts crouched flank to flank. After a while, the men found them so, crouched in a ditch. By that time, their voices sounded almost like the voices of children. The men squatted there until it was light enough to find their way back to the cars. Then it was Monday morning. The temperature began to rise Monday. On Tuesday, the night, the darkness after the hot day, is close, still, oppressive. As soon as Byron enters the house, he feels the corners of his nostrils whiten and tauten with the thick smell of the stale, man-kept house. And when Hightower approaches, the smell of plump, unwashed flesh and unfresh clothing, that odor of unfastidious sedentation, of static overflesh not often enough bathed, is well-nigh overpowering. Entering, Byron thinks, as he's thought before, that is his right, It may not be my way, but it is his way and his right. And he remembers how once he'd seemed to find the answer, as though by inspiration, divination. It is the odor of goodness. Of course it would smell bad to us that are bad and sinful. They sit again opposite one another in the study, the desk, the lighted lamp between. Byron sits again on the hard chair, his face lowered, still. His voice is sober, stubborn, the voice of a man saying something which will be not only unpleasing, but will not be believed. I'm going to find another place for her. A place where it'll be more private, where she can... Hightower watches his lowered face. Why must she move when she is comfortable there with a woman at hand if she should need one? Byron doesn't answer. He sits motionless, down-looking. His face is stubborn, still. Looking at it, Hightower thinks, it is because so much happens. Too much happens. That's it. Man performs, engenders so much more than he can or should have to bear. That's how he finds that he can bear anything. That's it. That's what is so terrible, that he can bear anything. Anything. He watches Byron. Is Mrs. Beard the only reason why she's going to move? Still, Byron doesn't look up, speaking in that still, stubborn voice. She needs a place where it'll be kind of home to her. She ain't got a whole lot more time, and in a boarding house where it's mostly just men. A room where it'll be quiet when her time comes, and not every darn horse trader or a court jury that passes through the hallway. I see, Hightower says. He watches Byron's face. And you want me to take her in here? Byron makes to speak, but the other goes on. His tone is cold, level. It won't do, Byron. If there were another woman here, living in the house. It's a shame, too, with all the room here, and the quiet. I'm thinking of her, you see, not myself. I wouldn't care what was said, thought. I'm not asking that. Byron doesn't look up. He can feel the other watching him. He thinks. He knows that's not what I meant, too. He knows. He just said that. I know what he's thinking. Reckon I expected it. I reckon it's not any reason for him to think different from other folks, even about me. I reckon you ought to know that. Perhaps he does know it, but Byron doesn't look up to see. He talks on in that dull, flat voice, down-looking, while beyond the desk, Hightower, sitting a little more than erect, looks at the thin, weather-hardened, labor-purged face of the man opposite him. I ain't gonna get you mixed up in it when it ain't none of your trouble. You haven't even seen her. I don't reckon you ever will. I reckon likely you never seen him to know it either. It's just that I thought maybe... His voice ceases. Across the desk, the unbending minister looks at him, waiting, not offering to help him. When it's a matter of not do, I reckon a man can trust himself for advice. But when it comes to a matter of doing, I reckon a fellow'd better listen to all the advice he can get. But I ain't gonna mix you up in it. I don't want you to worry about that. I think I know that, Hightower says. He watches the other's down-looking face. I'm not in life anymore, he thinks. That's why there's no use in even trying to meddle, interfere. He could hear me no more than that man and that woman. I and that child would hear or heed me if I tried to come back into life. But you told me she knows that he is here. Yes, Byron says, brooding. Out there where I thought the chance of harm ere a man or woman or child couldn't have found me. And she hadn't hardly got there, for I had to go and blab the whole thing. I don't mean that. You didn't know yourself then. I mean the rest of it. About him and the... That... It's been 3 days. She must know whether you told her or not. She must have heard by now. Christmas. Byron doesn't look up. I never said any more. After she asked about that little white scar by his mouth. All the time we were coming to town that evening, I was afraid she'd ask. I'd try to think up things to talk to her about so she wouldn't have a chance to ask me any more. And all the time, I thought I was keeping him from finding out that he'd not only run off and left her in trouble, he'd changed his name to keep her from finding him. And that now, when she found him at last, what she'd found was the bootlegger. She already knew it. Already knew that he was no good. He says now, with a kind of musing astonishment, I never even had any need to keep it from her, to lie it smooth. It was like she knew beforehand what I would say, that I was going to lie to her, like she'd already thought of that herself and that she already didn't believe it before I even said it. And that was all right, too. But the part of her that knew the truth, that I couldn't have fooled anyway. He fumbles, gropes, the unbending man beyond the desk watching him, not offering to help. It's like she was in two parts, and one of them knows that he's a scoundrel, but the other part believes that when a man and a woman are going to have a child, that the Lord will see that they're all together when the right time comes. Like it was God that looks after women to protect them from men. And if the Lord don't see fit to let them two parts meet and kind of compare, then I ain't going to do it either. Nonsense, Hightower says. He looks across the desk at the other's still, stubborn, ascetic face, the face of a hermit who's lived for a long time in an empty place, where sand blows. The thing, the only thing for her to do is to go back to Alabama, to her people. I reckon not, Byron says. He says it immediately with immediate finality, as if he's been waiting all the while for this to be said. She won't need to do that. I reckon she won't need to do that. But he doesn't look up. He can feel the other looking at him. Does Buck Brown know that she's in Jefferson? For an instant, Byron almost smiles. His lip lifts, a thin movement, almost a shadow, without mirth. He'd been too busy. After that $1,000. It's right funny to watch him. Like a man that can't play a tune, blowing a horn right loud, hoping that in a minute it'll begin to make music. Being drugged across the square on a handcuff every 12 or 15 hours, when likely they couldn't run him away if they was to sick them bloodhounds on him. He spent Saturday night in jail, still talking about how they were trying to beat him out of his $1,000,
by trying to make out that he helped Christmas do the killing. Till at last Buck Connor went up to his cell and told him he would put a gag in his mouth if he didn't shut up and let the other prisoners sleep. And he shut up. And Sunday night they went out with the dogs, and he raised so much racket that they had to take him out of jail and let him go too. But the dogs never got started, and him hollering and cussing the dogs and wanting to beat them because they never struck a trail, telling everybody again how it was him that reported Christmas first and that all he wanted was fair justice, until the sheriff took him aside and talked to him. They didn't know what the sheriff said to him. Maybe he threatened to lock him back up in jail and not let him go with him next time. Anyway, he calmed down some and they went on. Now, they never got back to town till late Monday night. He was still quiet. Maybe he was wore out. He hadn't slept none in some time, and they said how he was trying to outrun the dogs so that the sheriff finally threatened to handcuff him to a deputy to keep him back so the dogs could smell something besides him. He needed a shave already when they locked him up Saturday night, and he needed one bad by now. I reckon he must have looked more like a murderer than even Christmas. And he was cussing Christmas now, like Christmas had done hid out just for meanness, to spite him and to keep him from getting that $1,000. And they brought him back to jail and locked him up that night. And this morning, they went and took him out again, and they all went off with the dogs on a new scent. Folks said they could hear him hollering and talking till they were clean out of town. And she doesn't know that, you say? You say you have kept that from her. You'd rather that she knew him to be a scoundrel than a fool. Is that it? Byron's face is still again, not smiling now. It's quite sober. I don't know. It was last Sunday night after I came out to talk to you and went back home. I thought she'd be asleep in bed, but she was still sitting up in the parlor, and she said, "What is it? What's happened here?" And I didn't look at her, and I could feel her looking at me. I told her it was a nigger killed a white woman. I didn't lie then. I reckon I was so glad I never had to lie then, because before I thought, I'd done said and set the house afire. Then it was too late. I'd pointed out the smoke, and I'd told her about the two fellas named Brown and Christmas that lived out there. And I could feel her watching me the same as I can you now. And she said, "What was the nigger's name?" It's like God sees that they find out what they need to know out of men's lying without needing to ask. And that they don't find out what they don't need to know without even knowing they haven't found it out. And so, I don't know for sure what she knows and what she don't know. Except that I've kept it from her that it was the man she's hunting for that told on the murderer, and that he's in jail now. Except when he's out running with dogs, the man that took him up and befriended him. I have kept that from her. And what are you going to do now? Where does she want to move? She wants to go out there and wait for him. I told her that he's away on business for the sheriff, so I didn't lie altogether. She'd already asked me where he lived, and I'd already told her. And she said that was the place where she belonged until he come back, because that's his house. She said that's what he would want her to do. And I couldn't tell her different, that cabin is the last place in the world he would want her to ever see. She wanted to go out there as soon as I got home from the mill this evening. She had a bundle all tied up and her bonnet on, waiting for me to get home.
I started once going by myself, she said. But I wasn't sure I knowed the way. And I said, yes, only it was too late today, and we'd go out there tomorrow. And she said, it's an hour till dark yet. It ain't but 2 miles, is it? And I said to let's wait, because I'd have to ask first. And she said, ask who? Ain't it Lucas's house? And I could feel her watching me, and she said, I thought you said that that was where Lucas lived. And she was watching me. And she said, who is this preacher you keep on going to talk to about me? And you are going to let her go out there to live. It might be best. She'd be private out there, and she'd be away from all the talking till this business is over. You mean she's got her mind set on it and you won't stop her? You don't want to stop her. Byron doesn't look up. In a way, it is his house. Nice thing to a home of his own he'll ever own, I reckon. And he is her. Out there, alone with a child coming. The nearest house, a few Negro cabins, a half mile away. He watches Byron's face. Well, I've thought of that. There are ways, things that can be done. What things? What can you do to protect her out there? Byron doesn't answer at once. He doesn't look up. When he speaks, his voice is dogged. There are secret things a man can do without being evil, Reverend. No matter how they might look to folks. I don't think that you could do anything that would be very evil, Byron, no matter how it looked to folks. But are you going to undertake to say just how far evil extends into the appearance of evil? Just where between doing and appearing evil stops? No, Byron says. Then he moves slightly. He speaks as if he too were waking. Well, I hope not. I reckon I am trying to do the right thing by my lights. And that, Hightower thinks, is the first lie he ever told me. Ever told anyone. Man or woman, perhaps including himself. He looks across the desk at the stubborn, dogged, sober face that hasn't yet looked at him. Or maybe it isn't lie yet, because he doesn't know himself that it is so. He says, well, he speaks now with a kind of spurious brusqueness which, flabby-jowled and dark-cavern-eyed, his face belies. That has settled, then. You'll take her out there to his house, and you'll see that she is comfortable, and you'll see that she is not disturbed until this is over. And then you'll tell that man, Birch, Brown, that she is here. And he'll run, Byron says. He doesn't look up, yet through him there seems to go a wave of exultation, of triumph, before he can curb and hide it when it is too late to try. For the moment he doesn't attempt to curb it, back thrust too in his hard chair, looking for the first time at the minister with a face confident and bold and suffused. The other meets his gaze steadily. Is that what you want him to do? Hightower says. They sit so in the lamplight,
Through the open window comes the hot, myriad silence of the breathless night. Think what you are doing. You are attempting to come between man and wife. Byron has caught himself. His face is no longer triumphant, but he looked steadily at the older man. Perhaps he tried to catch his voice, too, but he can't yet. They ain't man and wife yet, he says. Does she think that? Do you believe that she will say that? They look at one another. Ah, Byron, Byron. What are a few mumbled words before God, before the steadfastness of a woman's nature, before that child? Well, he may not ruin, if he gets that reward, that money. Like enough he'll be drunk enough on $1,000 to do anything, even marry. Oh, Byron, Byron. Then what do you think I ought to do? What do you advise? Go away. Leave Jefferson. They look at one another. No, Hightower says, you don't need my help. You are already being helped by someone stronger than I am. For a moment, Byron doesn't speak. They look at one another steadily. Help by who? By the devil, Hightower says. And the devil is looking after him, too, Hightower thinks. He's in mid-stride, halfway home, his laden small market basket on his arm. Him, too. Him, too, he thinks, walking. It's hot. He's in his shirt sleeves, tall, with thin, black-clad legs and spare, gaunt arms and shoulders, and with that flabby and obese stomach like some monstrous pregnancy. The shirt is white, but it isn't fresh. His collar is soiled, as is the white lawn cravat carelessly knotted. And he hasn't shaved for 2 or 3 days. His Panama hat is soiled, and beneath it, between hat and skull against the heat, the edge and corners of a soiled handkerchief protrude. He's been to town to do his semi-weekly marketing, where, gaunt, misshapen, with his gray stubble and his dark, spectacle-blurred eyes and his black-rimmed hands and the rank man-odor of his sedentary and unwashed flesh, he entered the one odorous and cluttered store, which he patronized and paid with cash for what he bought. "Well, they found that nigger's trail at last," the proprietor said. "Negro?" Hightower said. He became utterly still in the act of putting into his pocket the change from his purchases. "That fella, now the murderer. I said all the time he wasn't right, wasn't a white man, that there was something funny about him, but you can't tell folks nothing until..." "Found him?" Hightower said. "You darn right they did. Why, the fool never even had sense enough to get out of the county. Yeah, the sheriff's been telephoning all over the country for him, and the blacksmith was right here under his darn nose all the time." "And they have..." He leaned forward against the counter above his laden basket. He could feel the counter edge against his stomach. It felt solid. Stable enough. It was more like the earth itself were rocking faintly, preparing to move. Then it seemed to move, like something released slowly and without haste in an augmenting swoop. And cleverly, since the eye was tricked into believing that the dingy shelves ranked with fly-specked tins and the merchant himself behind the counter hadn't moved. Outraging, tricking sense. And he thinking, I won't. I have bought immunity. I have paid. They ain't caught him yet, the proprietor said, but they will. The sheriff taken the dogs out to the church before daylight this morning. They ain't 6 hours behind him. To think that the darn fool never had no better sense. Show he's a nigger, even if nothing else. Then the proprietor was saying, was that all today? What? Hightower said. What? Was that all you wanted? Yes. Yes, that was... He began to fumble in his pocket, the proprietor watching him. His hand came forth, still fumbling. It blundered upon the counter, shedding coins. The proprietor stopped two or three of them as they were about to roll off the counter. What's this for? The proprietor said. For the... Hightower's hand fumbled at the laden basket. For... You already paid. The proprietor was watching him, curious. That's your change here that I just gave you. For the dollar bill. Oh, Hightower said. Yes, I just... The merchant was gathering up the coins. He handed them back. When the customer's hand touched his, it felt like ice. It says hot weather, the proprietor said. Does wear a man out. And you wanted to sit down a spell before you start home? But Hightower apparently didn't hear him. He was moving now toward the door while the merchant watched him. He passed through the door and into the street, the basket on his arm, walking stiffly and carefully like a man on ice. It was hot. Heat quivered up from the asphalt, giving to the familiar buildings about the square a nimbus quality, a quality of living in palpitant chiaroscuro. Someone spoke to him in passing. He didn't even know it. He went on, thinking, and him too, walking fast now so that when he turned the corner at last and entered that dead and empty little street where his dead and empty small house waited, he was almost panting. It's the heat, the top of his mind was saying to him, reiterant, explanatory. But still, even in the quiet street where scarce anyone ever paused now to look at, remember, the sign and his house, his sanctuary, already in sight, it goes on beneath the top of his mind that would cozen and soothe him. I won't. I have bought immunity. It's like words spoken aloud now. Reiterative, patient, justificative. I paid for it. I didn't quibble about the price. No man can say that. I just wanted peace. I paid them their price without quibbling. The street shimmers and swims. He's been sweating, but now even the air of noon feels cool upon him. Then sweat, heat, mirage, all rush fused into a finality which abrogates all logic and justification and obliterates it like firewood. I will not. When sitting in the study window in the first dark, he saw Byron pass into and then out of the street lamp. He sat suddenly forward in his chair. It wasn't that he was surprised to see Byron there at that hour. At first, when he first recognized the figure, he thought, "Ah, I had an idea he would come tonight. It is not in him to support even the semblance of evil." It was while he was thinking that he started, sat forward. For an instant after recognizing the approaching figure in the full glare of the light, he believed that he was mistaken. Knowing all the while that he couldn't be, that it could be no one except Byron, since he was already turning into the gate. "Tonight, Byron is completely changed. It shows in his walk, his carriage." Leaning forward, Hightower says to himself, as though he has learned pride or defiance. Byron's head is erect. He walks fast and erect. Suddenly, Hightower says, almost aloud, "He's done something. He's taken a step." He makes a clicking sound with his tongue, leaning in the dark window, watching the figure pass swiftly from sight beyond the window and in the direction of the porch, the entrance, and where in the next moment Hightower hears his feet and then his knock. "And he didn't offer to tell me," he thinks. "I would have listened. Let him think aloud to me." He's already crossing the room, pausing at the desk to turn on the light. He goes to the front door. "It's me, Reverend," Byron says. "I recognized you," Hightower says. "Even though you didn't stumble on the bottom step this time. You have entered this house on Sunday night, but until tonight you have never entered it without stumbling on the bottom step, Byron." This was the note upon which Byron's calls usually opened. This faintly overbearing note of levity and warmth to put the other at his ease, and on the part of the caller that slow and country-bred diffidence which is courtesy. Sometimes it would seem to Hightower that he would actually hail Byron into the house by a judicious application of pure breath, as though Byron wore a sail. But this time Byron is already entering, before Hightower has finished his sentence. He enters immediately with that new air born somewhere between assurance and defiance. "And I reckon you're going to find that you hate it worse when I don't stumble than when I do," Byron says. "Is that a hope, or is it a threat, Byron?" "Well, I don't mean it to be a threat," Byron says. "Ah," Hightower says. "In other words, you can offer no hope." "Well, I am forewarned, at least. I was forewarned soon as I saw you in the streetlight. But at least you are going to tell me about it. What you have already done, even if you didn't see fit to talk about it beforehand." They are moving toward the study door. Byron stops. He looks back and up at the taller face. "Then you know," he says. "You've already heard." Then, though his head hasn't moved, he's no longer looking at the other. "Well," he says. He says, "Well, any man has got a free tongue, woman too. But I would like to know who told you. Not that I'm ashamed. Not that I aim to keep it from you. I come to tell you myself when I could." They stand just without the door to the lighted room. Hightower sees now that Byron's arms are laden with bundles, parcels that look like they might contain groceries. "What," Hightower says, "what have you come to tell me? But come in. Maybe I do know what it is already, but I want to see your face when you tell me. I forewarn you, too, Byron. They enter the lighted room. The bundles are groceries. He's bought and carried too many like them himself not to know. Sit down, he says. No, Byron says, I ain't going to stay that long. He stands, sober, contained, with that air, compassionate still, but decisive without being assured, confident without being assertive. That air of a man about to do something which someone dear to him will not understand and approve, yet which he himself knows to be right, just as he knows that the friend will never see it so. He says, you ain't gonna like it, but there ain't anything else to do. I wish you could see it so, but I reckon you can't. And I reckon that's all there is to it. Across the desk, seated again, Hightower watches him gravely. What have you done, Byron? Byron speaks in that new voice. That voice brief, terse, each word definite of meaning, not fumbling. I took her out there this evening. I'd already fixed up the cabin, cleaned it good. She's settled now. She wanted it so. It was the nearest thing to a home he ever had and ever will have, so I reckon she's entitled to use it, especially as the owner ain't using it now, being detained elsewhere, you might say. I know you ain't gonna like it. You can name lots of reasons, good ones. You say it ain't his cabin to give her, all right. Maybe it ain't. But it ain't any living man or woman in this country or state to say she can't use it. You'll say that in her shape she ought to have a woman with her, all right. There is a nigger woman, one old enough to be sensible, that don't live over 200 yards away. She can call to her without getting up from the chair or the bed. You'll say, but that ain't a white woman. And I'll ask you, what will she be getting from the white women in Jefferson about the time the baby's due? When here she ain't been in Jefferson but a week, and already she can't talk to a woman 10 minutes before that woman knows she ain't married yet. And as long as that darn scoundrel stays above ground where she can hear of him now and then, she ain't going to be married. How much help will she be getting from the white ladies about that time? They'll see that she has a bed to lay on and walls to hide her from the street, all right. I don't mean that. And I reckon a man would be justified in saying she don't deserve no more than that, being as it wasn't behind no walls that she got in the shape she's in. But that baby never done the choosing. And even if it had, I'd be darned if any poor little tyke having to face what it'll have to face in this world deserves more than, better than, but I reckon you know what I mean. I reckon you can even say it. Beyond the desk, Hightower watches him while he talks in that level, restrained tone. Not once at a loss for words until he came to something still too new and nebulous for him to more than feel. And for the third reason, a white woman out there alone, you ain't gonna like that. And you'll like that least of all. Byron, Byron. Byron's voice is now dogging, yet he holds his head up still. I ain't in the house with her. I got a tent. It ain't close, neither. Just where I can hear her at need. And I fixed a bolt on the door. Any of them can come out at any time and see me in the tent. Byron, Byron. I know you ain't thinking what most of them think. Are thinking. I know you would know better, even if she wasn't. If it wasn't for...
I know you said that because of what you know that the others will think.
Hightower sits again in the attitude of the Eastern idol, between his parallel arms on the armrests of the chair. Go away, Myron. Go away now. At once. Leave this place forever, this terrible place, this terrible, terrible place. I can read you. You will tell me that you have just learned love. I will tell you that you have just learned hope. That's all hope. The object doesn't matter, not to the hope, not even to you. There is but one end to this, to the road that you are taking. Sin or marriage? And you would refuse the sin. That's it, God forgive me, it will, must be marriage or nothing with you. And you will insist that it be marriage. You will convince her, perhaps you already have. If she but knew it, would admit it. Else, why is she content to stay here and yet make no effort to see the man whom she's come to find? I cannot say to you, choose the sin, because you would not only hate me, you would carry that hatred straight to her. So I say, go away now, at once. Turn your face now and don't look back. But not this, Byron. They look at one another. I knew you wouldn't like it, Byron says. I reckon I done right not to make myself a guest by sitting down. But I didn't expect this. That you too would turn against a woman wronged and betrayed. No woman who has a child is ever betrayed. The husband of a mother, whether he be the father or not, is already a cuckold. Give yourself at least the one chance in 10, Byron. If you must marry, there are single women, girls, virgins. It's not fair that you should sacrifice yourself to a woman who has chosen once and now wishes to renege that choice. It's not right. It's not just. God didn't intend it so when he made marriage. Made it. Women made marriage. Sacrifice? Me, the sacrifice? Seems to me the sacrifice. Not to her. For the Lena Groves, there are always two men in the world, and their number is legion. Lucas Virches and Byron Bunches. But no Lena, no woman deserves more than one of them. No woman. There have been good women who were martyrs to brutes in their cups and such. But what woman, good or bad, has ever suffered from any brute as men have suffered from good women? Tell me that, Byron. They speak quietly, without heat, giving pause to weigh one another's words, as two men already impregnable, each in his own conviction, will. I reckon you're right, Byron says. Anyway, ain't for me to say that you're wrong. And I don't reckon it's for you to say that I'm wrong. Even if I am. No, Hightower says. Even if I am, Byron says. So I reckon I'll say goodnight, he says quietly. It's a good long walk out there.
Yes, Hightower says. I used to walk it myself now and then. It must be about 3 miles. 2 miles, Byron says. Well, he turns. Hightower doesn't move. Byron shifts the parcels, which he hasn't put down. I'll say goodnight, he says, moving toward the door. I reckon I'll see you sometime soon. Yes, Hightower says. Is there anything I can do? Anything you need? Bedclothes and such? I'm obliged. I reckon she has a plenty. There was some already there. I'm obliged. And you will let me know if anything comes up. If the child... Have you arranged for a doctor? I'll get that attended to. But have you seen one yet? Have you engaged one? Well, I aim to see all that. And I'll let you know. Then he's gone. From the window again, Hightower watches him pass and go on up the street toward the edge of town and his 2 mile walk, carrying his paper wrapped packages of food. He passes from sight, walking erect and at a good gait, such a gait as an old man already gone to flesh and short wind, an old man who's already spent too much time sitting down, couldn't have kept up with. And Hightower leans there in the window in the August heat, oblivious of the odor in which he lives, that smell of people who no longer live in life, that odor of overplump desiccation and stale linen, as though a precursor of the tomb. Listening to the feet, which he seems to hear still long after he knows that he can't. Thinking. God bless him. God help him. Thinking to be young. To be young. There's nothing else like it. There's nothing else in the world. He's thinking quietly. I shouldn't have got out of the habit of prayer. Then he hears the feet no longer. He hears now only the myriad and interminable insects, leaning in the window, breathing the hot, still, rich, maculate smell of the earth, thinking of how, when he was young, a youth, he'd loved darkness. Of walking or sitting alone among trees at night. Then the ground, the bark of trees, became actual, savage, filled with, evocative of, strange and baleful half-delights and half-terrors. He was afraid of it. He feared. He loved in being afraid. Then one day, while at the seminary, he realized that he was no longer afraid. It was as though a door had shut somewhere. He was no longer afraid of darkness. He just hated it. He would flee from it, to walls, to artificial light. Yes, he thinks, I should never have let myself get out of the habit of prayer. He turns from the window. One wall of the study is lined with books. He pauses before them, seeking, until he finds the one which he wants. It's Tennyson. It's dog-eared.
He's had it ever since the seminary. He sits beneath the lamp and opens it. It doesn't take long. Soon the fine galloping language, the gutless swooning full of sapless trees and dehydrated lusts, begins to swim smooth and swift and peaceful. It's better than praying, without having to bother to think aloud. It's like listening in a cathedral to a eunuch chanting in a language which he doesn't even need to not understand.